Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to great women about what motivates them in their lives and their work so that they can inspire us in our own lives. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Fiona Thomas. Hello and welcome, Fiona.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Pleasure. And you're from Glasgow.
I'm from Glasgow originally, but I've lived in Birmingham since 2016.
Fiona is an author of Depression in the Digital Age, about the highs and lows of perfectionism. So Fiona, you write about mental health with an open honesty, but the online world helped you shape your own identity, didn't it?
Yep, absolutely. I started a blog in 2012. Basically, I had a mental breakdown when I was 26 back in 2012, and I had to quit my job to kind of rebuild my mental health, rebuild my life, get my confidence back. And when I was off work for about a year, I just started a blog for fun. Back in the days when there wasn't really kind of YouTube or Instagram influencers, really just, you know, you could start a blog for fun. So I decided to do that. And basically in the online world, I just felt so much more comfortable and so much more free to express myself and talk about what I was going through with my mental health. So when I say that the online world shaped my identity, it really just gave me a kind of like a blank slate to just say, kind of over time, just slowly be honest about who I really was, as opposed to this, you know, it's kind of the opposite of how people see it nowadays. I felt like I was putting on a persona in my real life, face to face with people. I was pretending to be someone that I wasn't, but online, I could be who I really was.
Gosh, that's interesting, and that'll help a lot of people. So you went through an awful lot, and you actually suffered burnout. I mean, how did that manifest itself? How did you actually feel?
So I've only really come to the realisation that it was burnout recently, because burnout has been really topical. It's been in the news loads, like every millennial has burnout apparently, which I can quite believe. But at the time it was diagnosed straight away as depression. And I believe it was burnout, and had I caught it at the beginning before it escalated out of control, I would have been able to deal with it quite efficiently and get back to work quickly and get on with life a lot quicker. But for me, it manifested itself in just complete and utter mental fatigue, exhaustion, unable to do basic tasks. So at the time, I was in a busy corporate kind of catering job. So I was managing a business, and I had a lot of things to do day to day, meetings, managing staff. And over time, I just found that I couldn't actually get through my to-do list. And it was the same, you know, it was quite a monotonous job. You do the same things every day, but I would look at the list and just couldn't connect my brain to my body to actually do the thing. So it may be like phone in a milk order for tomorrow, and I just sit and look at the phone and go, I just can't pick up that phone. I don't know why. I don't understand. I was getting to feel quite out of body and feeling like I don't really understand what's going on in my brain right now. And the worst thing I probably did was when I was learning to drive, I drove on the wrong side of the road in a lesson and didn't realise. I was just like driving down, and the instructor was like, "Hey, can you pull over, please?"
Yes, not engaging or processing the brain. It's a very powerful tool. And I think a lot of people will resonate with what you're saying. You know, there's a lot of pressure there. Now, what do you think about the dangers of people craving perfectionism in our modern world?
I think for me, it was funny because when my editor suggested that tagline for the book, it's always been Depression in a Digital Age. And he said, I think the second part of the title should be The Highs and Lows of Perfectionism. And I argued with him because I was like, I'm not a perfectionist, and I argued with him for ages. And then I realised, like, oh, the fact that I'm arguing about this probably proves that I'm a bit of a perfectionist. So it's something that I didn't even really realise until I was maybe like two-thirds of the way through the book, that I realised, gosh, it really is this quest for unachievable perfectionism, which loads, I feel like a lot of people that have to deal with just now, especially because everything in our lives is like seems to have a number attached to it, whether it's Instagram or Twitter, or even like if you're trying to lose weight, everything's a number, or if you're trying to get better at fitness, everything's on an app, everything's trackable. But there never seems to be like an end point. There never seems to be a finish line. So we're all chasing this number and just wanting it to get better and better and better and higher all the time. So I think when you realize that you're chasing a number that's constantly unreachable, then I think it makes life a bit easier.
Lot of pressure, isn't it? Seeking the unachievable goals, as you say, gosh. And it's okay to not be okay, really. I mean, you advocate quitting something to save your mental health, really. I think that's a lesson to everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. I, throughout the book, talk a lot about things that I've given up or things that I've quit in order to save my mental health. There's a chapter that's all about giving up losing my career, giving up alcohol, and cutting ties with one of my best friends. Because sometimes when you're recovering from mental illness, you have to make difficult decisions, and it's a lot of hard work. It's the same with self-worth and self-esteem. You don't just wake up one day and feel good about yourself. You actually have to put in the work, and it sometimes it is about making really difficult decisions that make your life harder in the here and now, but in the long run it's worth it. But yeah, I quit my job, which at the time I was absolutely distraught about, because I just felt without my job that I was a nobody, and it wasn't like a particularly good job.
And did you find out who you were?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I realized that the amazing career that I thought I had, what that was doing was draining me of any happiness, kind of any job satisfaction. Not that it was a bad job, but it just wasn't fulfilling my needs. It didn't give me any time to do anything creative. And I did study music at university, so I was always creative, but just at uni realized, music isn't where I'm meant to be, so I'm not going to have a career in music. And I think I just resigned myself that I wasn't going to have a creative job, and that I wasn't good enough creatively to kind of make a career out of it. So when I went into my proper job, I didn't do anything creative, and I think that definitely had a lot to do with the decline in my mental health, because I just wasn't doing anything for myself to feed that part of my brain.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. I think music with therapy, or creativity with therapy, anything that gives people downtime certainly can alleviate some of the pressure, and people can learn from that. I mean, young people today are affected massively by the extreme pressures of society, and it's really hard to deal with, as you say, perfectionism, how you look, high levels of anxiety, fear of success. It's an epidemic. So you coped and you turned your life around. How would we help them to cope? Where would they turn, people that are feeling some of the things that you have been feeling?
Yeah, it's difficult, because I don't think people ask me for my advice all the time, and obviously I'm not a health professional. I've only got my own experience, but I do feel like I've done a lot of trial and error, and I've done a lot of work on myself just through constantly wanting to be better and wanting to be more emotionally aware. And I think being aware of your emotions is like the first step, and can be a thread that runs through your recovery that can always get better and always help.
I heard that the other day, actually. Feel your feelings is something that's really important, to not be afraid of however you're feeling, whatever it is, subconscious, conscious mind. Feel your feelings, own them, and then you can process them and deal with whatever it is that you're dealing, because no one else knows what someone's going through.
And don't pretend you're okay. I wrote an article recently about toxic positivity, which is just all about this kind of fake air of positivity that is thrown at us all the time, and we're all supposed to pretend to be okay and think positive. And that's just one of the worst things you can do if you're feeling rubbish, because what happens is you actually then don't know how to process emotions. You have to go through feelings of anxiety and worry and sadness and hopelessness so that you acknowledge it and you feel it, because those feelings are normal. They're a part of just being a human, and you process them and it builds up your resilience so that when you feel them in the future, you know this is okay and I will get through it because I got through it before. So this stifling emotions, any emotions, is just so harmful, and it'll always come out somehow in the long run. So you are just better dealing with it on that day and dealing with it as best you can.
Definitely. No, you talk a lot of sense with that. You know, it's sort of positivity is great when you're feeling positive in between dealing with whatever you've got to deal with, and that's okay too.
And happiness is not, this feeling of happy is not necessarily like an attainable emotion. Happiness, I was speaking to a therapist and she said happiness is fleeting. You know, it can last a few minutes, but then actually the best thing you can hope for is just kind of peacefulness and acceptance for whatever you're feeling.
That's better, because people have been craving happiness for a long time, haven't they? And again, an unattainable goal sometimes, and you're right, you know, to get peace and calm and in your own mind and to have health, you know, is incredible. So the pressure on millennials and youth of today, you know, the pressure to be attractive, to be cool, to be popular, to do well at school, to know what they're good at, what career path they take. There's a lot, isn't there? There's a lot of pressure on them.
Yeah, and definitely for me, I was born in 86, so I'm like an old millennial.
If you're an old millennium, I'm a very old non-millennium. So everything became too much in your life. And as you say, you know, people don't know what's going on inside someone's head. So I saw in your book, you felt rage, not wanting to face anyone, feeling like you were unable to cope. I mean, it was literally rage, was it? Anger that you didn't know where that came from?
I felt a lot of emotions. Like rage was definitely... I went through a phase of feeling very, very angry about my mental illness, and I felt like it was this thing that had been inflicted on me, and I felt like it had taken so much of my life away. So it took away my career, it prolonged things like moving house, getting married. Like I lost so many years of my life to just trying to get back up to feeling well enough to work. So I was very angry about mental illness for that, but now that time's passed, like I definitely feel a sense of acceptance, and I am actually so grateful for all that I've been through with my mental illness, because it's just taught me, it's just inevitable, it was just going to happen, because I was always going to be this person that was an overachiever, and it was never ever going to pan out, because I was always going to feel like a failure. So I just feel like it was an inevitable journey for me, but it's helped me reconnect with what I actually want out of life. So yeah, I think, and I wouldn't have anything to write a book about if I hadn't had
there
a
you are
breakdown.
And help others, and everything slotted into place. You are one influential woman. So blogging helped you. You talk in your book about the pre and post internet years. I mean, it's hard to believe you were sort of pre-internet years as well, but payphones, queuing up for payphones, calculators, dial-up networking. Now people have instant gratification, connection, comparison, insecurities. It's much harder now, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think my issue is people instantly go to all the bad things that social media has given us. People are obsessed with their phones, and people aren't talking in real life. People aren't meeting up and staying in contact with people. And that is true, but I also feel like there's this whole other side that nobody talks about, especially with the mental health community, because we are the kind of people who maybe can't reach out in real life, and maybe go through weeks or months where we're isolated and we don't want to talk to anyone, we can't leave the house. So actually having the ability to speak to someone on Instagram or Twitter or via text message, or like this recording, you know, with someone who's not even anywhere near you, it's such a lifeline for people who feel isolated. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that should be underplayed, because it does help people. It gives people that step and that confidence to then get on with the rest of their stage of recovery.
Yes.
For me, definitely Instagram stories has been amazing, because I started using that in talking to the camera about how I was feeling that day. And that gave me the confidence to then, and no joke, it was a direct link, that gave me the confidence to then, in real life, when I meet strangers, say, my name is Fiona, I had a mental breakdown when I was 26, I'm a mental health blogger, I'm an author. It just gave me that confidence to actually own all the things that I had previously been kind of ashamed about.
Good for you. And so there's a positive and a negative with online communities, as you'd mentioned. Now, you described anxiety really well in your book. I'll just read a little bit of the book, thank you, that you kindly sent me here. Anxiety doing its finest job, heightening all of my senses, making me catastrophize, or making a catastrophe out of tiny errors like an overflowing bin. I felt out of control and angry. I mean, that can help others going through anxiety to actually understand what it is.
Yeah, because so, I didn't know I had depression at all in the beginning. I just thought I was stressed, because I'd never, ever spoken to someone about what it's like to actually have depression. I've got family members who've got depression, but we never, ever spoke about it. And now I know that it is difficult to talk about face-to-face. So, but like you say, being able to write it down, it helps you kind of unjumble the thoughts and explain yourself better.
And you did that with the doctor as well, didn't you? You did that, you know, because that helped you actually explain to the doctor, because it's not a physical thing, it's much harder.
Yeah, well, I had this fear, like so many people do, that when I went to the doctor that he was going to laugh me out of his office and say, don't be so stupid, everybody's stressed at their work, go away. So that's why I wrote everything down, because I was so kind of like excitable, like I was just a nervous ball of energy, that I thought, if I go in there, I'm not going to be able to figure out what to say. So I wrote everything down on a bit of paper, just all my symptoms, and then when I wrote them down, I thought, oh my goodness, there are a lot of them, like feeling tearful all the time, feeling really irritable, unable to do daily tasks, unable to make decisions, all these things that just kind of added up. So I just went in and kind of recited them recited them to the doctor, and then started crying. And then that's when they diagnosed me with stress in the beginning, and then after a week off work, things just went downhill really quickly. And I think that was just the, you know, when you're so stressed, you're just spinning plates and just holding it all together. But because I had a week off to kind of rest and sit in the feelings that I was having, that's when I realized, oh, this is actually really a lot, goes a lot deeper than just surface level stress. And that's when I was diagnosed with depression.
So it's the tip of the iceberg, and you needed that calm. Gosh, so we can look at it as a life event happening to and controlling us, or we can take the reins like you have and control our own life. So it's helping get permission from friends and family and doctors to say permission to not be okay, really, isn't it?
Oh yeah, getting a diagnosis I think is so important for people, because it just gives you, it's not about separating yourself from the illness, it's more about getting that, like you say, permission. Yes, this is really happening to you. Yes, it's got a name, and yes, there is an action plan to get you out of this. And a lot of the time I was finding that I was kind of, that I was asking for help, you know, kind of quietly from colleagues and my boss and my family, but they didn't really see what was going on underneath the surface. So it was like that iceberg thing where, you know, I was like, can I maybe get a little bit of help? But they didn't really understand how bad it was. So having a doctor give it a diagnosis was so helpful, because then when I went back to my parents and said, I've got depression, they were like, oh God, okay, how can we help?
Brilliant. So well done you, and a lot of people could do that and learn from that now, because yes, it's knowing who to turn to and how and when, really, isn't it? That's the key. So you mentioned that you went on a cycle of self-destruction and drank too much. And alcohol in itself is a depressant, isn't it? And makes people mood worse. And they say you should only ever drink if you're happy, which people don't know until they start drinking. So how did you stop? How did you break the cycle?
So I basically went really deep into it before I realised that I had to stop. So I was on antidepressants and the doctor had said, you know, you probably shouldn't drink whilst you're on these. But I just didn't really take it very seriously. I definitely shouldn't have been drinking, but I kind of had to push myself to the absolute limits to realise that it wasn't helping, because it was just a crutch. I just wanted to drink to feel... I was drinking really to get the confidence to socialise, because I was feeling really anxious. So I would drink so that I could go out and socialise, and I thought, well, this is good because it's getting me out of the house and it's helping me see my friends and stuff. But it always ended badly. And if I had a big drinking binge, it would set me back for a week or 2 weeks where I couldn't get out of bed for 2 weeks. So really, it just got so bad that I just woke up one morning and thought, I think it was New Year's Day one year. I woke up and I thought, this really can't go on, can it? And I think I thought, like, I'll not drink for January. And then I saw such an improvement in my mood. I thought this is just the tip of the iceberg. I need to keep going. So I just went cold turkey, and it was really difficult because I just wanted to drink all the time. And I was never an alcoholic. It was just that go-to. It's like when you're a comfort eater, you've just got that repetitive thing where that's the thing you lean on to feel better.
Numb the pain.
Yeah, exactly. So I just made a big deal of telling everyone, like, not drinking. Don't let me drink. And I had a lot of people saying, oh, you could just have one. But I just knew in myself, if I have one, I'll never stop. So it was really difficult, and that definitely fed into my social anxiety, because whenever I was in a group, I'd explain to people, and I hated it. At that point, I was nowhere near as open as I am now. So I just have to make excuses, like, oh, I'm on antibiotics, or I'm up early tomorrow, or I'd have to say to my friends, if we're there with people we've not met, can you tell those people not to ask me why I don't drink? But absolutely worth it. I would recommend anyone, if you think you're drinking a bit too much, then try and give it up and just see how much better you feel.
Definitely. And exercise helped you as well, didn't it?
Yes, but it was a bit of a slippery slope, because I talk about in the book how I got into exercise just as I was diagnosed. So then... But that was the one thing that I always did pretty much every day. I always went to the gym or went to an exercise class. And that gave me that boost of endorphins, made me feel good, got me out of the house. And then I started to see the weight drop off and get a bit toned, and was looking healthier. And it definitely made me feel good. But then it started to make me feel bad, because I was then using it as a weird form of self-abuse, because I just was going to the gym for like 2 or 3 hours a day, every single day, restricting my food intake. So I almost kind of shifted it from doing it for health reasons to then doing it as like a form of punishment. And then it was linked into my self-esteem. So I was just wanting to look better, even though I wasn't feeling better. And everyone was saying, you look so good, you look amazing, you're so fit. And I was like, yeah. But really inside, I just felt awful. But now I've addressed that all. I don't diet anymore. I only exercise for my mental health. That's the only reasons I exercise now. And I do what I want to do based on how I'm feeling. So it might be yoga, it might be walking or running or lifting weights. And I try not to put pressure on myself to do it for anything other than just pure enjoyment.
Brilliant. So you've come out the other side of that harrowing tunnel. So you were very creative at university, but unfulfilled, as you mentioned. It's such a pressure on people to choose the right course, and nowadays, and saddled with debt makes it even harder. University can be a terrifying experience for some of the millennials now, out of their comfort zone, no loyal friends, they're learning to cook, they're working hard all the time, they feel vulnerable, it's an unspoken adjustment, and again is isolating. So how can they cope with all of those pressures and embrace the change?
Yeah, I would say just accept that you're not an adult yet. Don't think that you have to have everything sorted out. You don't have to change your sheets every 2 weeks. It's fine. Like, you're a student, just be a student and be messy and take your washing home to your mum. Like, your parents will want to continue to look after you in that way if they can. You know, try and be sensible with your finances if you can. I would say getting a part-time job can actually be quite helpful, even though it can add to your workload. But I found having a part-time job was great because it just gave me a reason to set better boundaries with university work. So I would work in the evenings or at the weekends, and I actually really looked forward to going to work because I thought, I don't have to study. I can just come here and be sociable and be productive and earn a bit of money.
And meet new people helps.
Yes, absolutely. People who aren't at uni as well, so you get a different kind of perspective on life.
Yes.
Just don't think that you've got to have it all figured out. Because I decided I wasn't going to get a job in music, I felt this huge pressure to get a job straight away. And I just rushed to get into this career that I didn't want. Yep. But I just felt like I had to rush to the top of the ladder to prove to myself that because I didn't get a job in my degree, the subject that I did my degree in, I thought, I need to hurry up and prove to the world that this wasn't all for nothing and that I can still be an adult. Whereas I wish I had just waited and taken my time and just figured out what I wanted to do.
Yes, I think you'll help a lot of people out there. You know, you really will. So the digital world saved you, as you said. You found your voice, your community, your tribe, and that can help others feel better about themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I think being honest on social media is just like the best thing I ever did, because all I get from people is just people saying like, oh, I'm so glad that you're having a bad day as well. Like I said, I'm not out there to give advice to people or tell people how to live their lives, but it's just documenting honestly what I'm going through, and so many people find that helpful because it kind of cuts through all the fakery that is online of people, you know, having perfect breakfasts and like having perfect outfit every day, a brand new outfit every day. Like, who on earth are these people? Just try and be honest online and encourage other people to do that as well, because I don't think we can complain about the fakery on social media if we are part of the problem.
Yes, so be real and true to yourself. And I think they look to you as you've been through something the same as they're going through that's really difficult for them to overcome, and you've come out the other side. So I think that's where it's you that they're looking up to.
Yeah, and I'm still going through it. That's like, I'm still like, the past week for me has been a really bad depressive episode, and I've documented that as much as I can on Instagram. And I've found that really cathartic, and people are saying like, we hope you're okay, but also thanks for sharing it. I'm not like, I'm cured now. I just try and share that ongoing journey.
Yes. Well, that is something that, yes, people wouldn't have known, actually, and that's good to know. You know, it's not cured forever. It means it's hard work, and just keep working on yourself and looking after yourself, isn't it? Yeah. I've also heard you talk about imposter syndrome, which is huge as well, isn't it, for confidence for women and girls, thinking that they can't do something and lacking confidence. How did you get your confidence back then?
So, again, takes a lot of work and practice, and definitely I hate people saying it, but fake it till you make it is literally the best piece of advice for imposter syndrome. So I started explaining that I am an author, a mental health advocate, all these things. So I started kind of putting that on my social media, and that really helped. So having it in my bio and on Instagram and Twitter, and just not waiting for permission for someone to say you are a writer. So if you write, you are a writer. If you paint, then you are a painter. Don't wait for someone to tell you that it's okay to go and do that thing. So yeah. Social media helped me with that, because I just kind of added it into all my little online spaces, and I had my blog, and just practiced kind of being this person that I wanted to be. And then more recently, I've got a more like kind of concrete way of dealing with it. So I make a list of all my achievements, and that's like evidence. So whenever you're feeling like an imposter, you can go back to this list of evidence and basically prove your inner voice wrong. So if you're saying like, oh, I don't have any right to be going on this podcast because I don't have anything interesting to say, so then I'll go back to this list and say, well, I wrote a book, you know, I've been published on all these amazing websites and publications. Look at these messages that somebody sent you saying how much you've helped them. Look at these emails of, you know, really great feedback you've got from the events you've spoken at. So having stuff like that on hand for me is really, really important. It doesn't take much thinking, really. You can just go to that place and look at it and say, it's right, here's all the proof, you know, and just kind of fight off that inner critic, and being aware of that inner critic that's in your head, and acknowledge that it's not fact, it's just a voice.
And I think if everyone was honest, I think everyone's got an inner voice of doubt, you know, sometimes. And you certainly are helping a lot of people out there. And a lot of our listeners are young and, you know, struggling with an awful lot of things and, you know, everyday life, or, you know, just normal, real life people. And so, you know, whether I'm talking to a celebrity about their life and what they've been through, and talking to you as a young author, you know, it's fabulous and it really helps people. And they can take something that you've said and turn their life around. And that's why, you know, you're an influential woman in that way, because you're influencing how people think and feel. And that's what our podcast is all about. It's helping people feel and be motivated and inspired to do something or to tell someone to help them. So thank you for that.
And one thing I always tell people is that Tom Hanks gets imposter syndrome.
Definitely. And I listened to his interview once, and he's had an incredibly difficult life. And I think he's lived in, you know, five different families or five different houses as he was a child or something. I heard something like that, may not be right. But a lot of people, you know, have had incredible failure to get success and been through an awful lot that we don't know about. So who have you met that has inspired or influenced you?
Oh, so the reason I wrote my book really was because I read two books that really spoke to me. One was Control Alt Delete by Emma Gannon. So I think she's slightly younger than me, but she wrote her memoir all about growing up with the internet. And then I also read Bryony Gordon's Mad Girl, which is her memoir about OCD. So I read the two of them when I was on holiday, and I thought, oh, these books have made me realise that there is a place for my story, and that there is a way to talk about mental health in a like accessible and funny way. Like, it doesn't have to be a pity party. So those two books really inspired me, and those two women both really inspired me to talk about mental health, and also to just, you know, unashamedly just go for what you want, and don't think that you can't do something. Just prove everybody wrong and go for it, and don't apologize for that.
Make it happen. And in fact, Emma, I've been wanting to talk to you for some time, so we'll have to get her on and give you a shout out then, won't we? The proudest moment of your career then, that must have been your book then, is it?
Yeah. The day it was published was a weird one, because I work from home, so I was just at home kind of looking at my book, like hoping that people would buy it. Probably the most exciting part of the book was we had a book launch in January. It came out in November, but we had a book launch in January in Waterstones in Birmingham. And that was just really exciting, because there was a great turnout. It was a mixture of like friends and the bloggers that I've got to know in Birmingham, and then people that I've never met before coming along. And my friend Jo, who is a she's quite a well-known Instagrammer, Jo from Lobella Loves. She came along and hosted it. So it was really nice to have a back and forth with someone that I really respect. So we had an amazing conversation, and then I signed books and stuff. So that was one of those moments where I was really mindful of being present in it. And I was like drinking it all in and just feeling the love and feeling really appreciative for that moment and that night. And my book being in existence. Yeah.
Good for you. What an achievement. You should be proud. That's fantastic. Now, how do you occupy your time when you're not working? You do some exercise and that helped you get out of the house.
Yeah, exercise, yoga, and I mean, honestly, just a lot of Netflix.
like all millennials, including my teenagers.
Yeah, my husband and I are mega into just watching films. He's in video production, so yeah, we like very into watching marathons and watching movies, and that's it really. And I travel down to Wales quite a bit because one of my best friends I met on Instagram, and she lives in Wales, so I go and see her quite a bit. Or I'll travel back to Scotland and see my family. So yeah, very chilled. I'm trying to read more as well. But that's one of the difficult things with social media, is you just always pick up your phone instead of picking up a book.
That's your next thing. And the book launch in Edinburgh or Scotland somewhere, I think, is needed. So do you have a mantra for living your life?
I think just be honest and authentic. No matter what that means, if it's saying that you're nervous about something, saying that you're anxious, saying that you don't feel good enough, just be honest about those feelings, because when you're in a room full of people who are pretending to be okay, if you're the first one to raise your hand and say, this is a bit scary, everybody will go, oh my God, me too. So if you can be the first person to just acknowledge something like that, I feel like it's really powerful, and people are so thankful when you're the person that says, I'm not feeling that great.
Good for you, definitely. And someone I once heard a quote that said, comparison is the road to unhappiness. And I think that's quite true as well, isn't it? That when we compare ourselves to other people and think that, you know, they've got the answer, the perfect life, the most X, Y, and Z.
You know, the best part, the best version of other people, but you just don't know what's going on behind the scenes. And you don't know how much work that person's put in either, you know, especially with influencers, when you see people, oh, how, you know, she got a free holiday to Disneyland. You know, she's just getting things handed out. But you don't know how many late nights and overtime and how much work that person's done for free for all these years to then be offered this one-off free thing. We're always comparing ourselves to the best version of that person, and it's never like that. It's never an accurate portrayal of what's going on.
Don't be that envious person. Exactly. I mean, we look at I saw something about Victoria Beckham the other day, who you know, has the most amazing business, the most amazing life, amazing figure, whatever, and I saw that she gets up for 3 hours before her children get up in the morning to go in the gym, and then when she drops them off, she goes back in the gym in order to get on with everything else she's got in her life. And you just think, that's why she looks like that, and actually good on her. And probably helps her get on with her day as if she needs to. So lastly what would we say to others? I mean, you've said an incredible lot that will help them feel better about themselves, but to help them feel less low or isolated and shift that ton of bricks that is sitting on their shoulders that we don't even know about, How can we help them be happier, turn their life around, and get them to get others to listen more to their stuff?
Yeah, I would say just talk to someone. It's really hard. I was lucky that the first doctor I spoke to was really understanding, but I know a lot of people go to the doctor and they don't get the answer that they want. I would say please don't take that as a final answer. Keep talking when you feel comfortable and get a second opinion. Talk to, even if it's at work, talk to someone in HR, because they'll know more about mental health than maybe like your colleague or your line manager. Go online and speak to people on forums, speak to people on Instagram. There's private Facebook groups for people who've got mental illness. If people in your close circle, like your friends and family, just don't understand, there are so many people out there that do understand how you feel. And once you get the medical help, so once you get a GP who can maybe prescribe you medication or counselling if you need it, I feel there's this gap for people who just need peer support. So try and find that if you can, because having someone who understands what you're going through is so helpful. It doesn't need to be, you know, we're not offering solutions. It's just someone saying how you feel is totally valid. So find someone who helps validate your feelings, and that's so helpful.
That's really special. Thank you for that. Because whether people's feeling in full-on depression or a touch of anxiety or a bit scared or in pain and suffering from something going on in their life, I think all of that will help them. But I think it's been a really, really lovely interview. Thank you for your time. This Influential Women's podcast is presented by Nikki Bannerman and co-produced with Juliet Nichols. Please keep listening for more podcasts and subscribe for free on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher and Spotify. And please rate and review our podcast. And please share with everyone you know, all those Instagrammers, all those books that you read and all of those friends in Birmingham and Scotland.